just got back from the October Apple event. It was held on October 31st. No, 32nd.
Don't hurt our feelings.
All right. Well, I mean, there is some stuff here. So the funny thing is, there's never a guarantee. Like the iPhone event in September, that's guaranteed.
Yeah.
There's never a guarantee of an October Apple event. There just happens to be a slight pattern of every few years, sometimes back to back, there's an October event for, you know, whether it's Mac, iPad, something additional. You know, I think wasn't your point a few weeks ago that the 2016 MacBook Pro redesign was that plus the Apple TV HD?
No, it wasn't the Apple TV HD. It was the Apple TV app. So not even the hardware. The hardware was the year before because the TVOS stuff started in 2015.
Oh, yeah.
And then a year later, they had an event where they announced the Apple TV app. Mm-hmm. And then obviously at that point, it wasn't connected to a streaming service or anything. It didn't have channels. It was just the integration of the different, you know, the other cable provider apps that you have installed.
Yeah.
So it was that at the beginning. And then they did the 16-inch, they did the 15-inch MacBook Pro, i.e. the 2016 redesign one that everyone hates.
I need to go back and watch that because that just seems like unbelievable. Was it an hour long?
I didn't believe it. Someone tweeted it at me.
Yes.
And I was like, what? And then I looked and I was like, wow, that is actually it. Yeah.
I got the app and the box mixed up again. That's the thing that happens. My favorite is whenever they do, I think this is what they did with the actual like Apple TV fourth generation, which is they have a September event for the new iPhones and the Apple Watch, and they also show what will come in November. You know,
yes.
So I think that event was, I think it was an iPhone and Apple Watch event, and they were also showed
the iPad Pro, the big one.
Yeah, the big iPad Pro and the, which was like the first one, and the Apple TV fourth generation. And that's cool because you can plan out like the rest of your fall. you get your launch dates, and you're not this year. Obviously, is very messy, and maybe it's like necessary that they couldn't do that because of unknown release dates. But if things are coming this fall, that we're not part of that like hour and a half event in September, then that would have been ideal. If there's not, you know, clearly there's not an event in October.
The tags are the kind of thing that would have been an exact candidate for like coming in November, but we previewing it at the iPhone event because it has a connection to the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like an accessory product for the holidays that we don't offer to date, so we can't cannibalize ourselves in the 2 month interim, kind of like what they do with AirPods, right? Because mm-hmm. they announced AirPods with iPhone 7, but it was coming a month later, and then it was 2 months later or whatever. So
yeah, that's true.
But I think what we've seen is them being very conservative about announcing anything too soon that they aren't dead sure is actually coming out.
That's fair.
In light of recent issues with the software schedule, and obviously the AirPower stuff still looms over a little bit. So maybe we would have seen more announcements by now if it wasn't 2019, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On 9to5Mac Stack Trace podcast with Guy Rambo and John Sandel, anytime they mention AirPower, you hear the sound. Like when the phone...
The chime.
Yeah, the charging chime. And so now, I don't do that, but... effort, but I can hear it on my head whenever you say it.
Chime. It's a nice sound.
It is nice. It lives on in Stack Trace podcast. But yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I'll be honest. I was kind of like not interested in the whole Apple tag tracking device thing, you know, when that first came. It just sounded like it was so weird and abstract compared to anything else Apple makes, but I'm finding more and more things that I'd put it on and track. Like for example, I bought a couple of nice bikes for me and my wife, and then I'd put it on that because it's not enough for its own like GPS tracker. But if we can do this system, then cool. And then we have two dogs now, and so we put it on the dog's tag, you know, like literally on their dog collars. My daughter's backpack, things like that. I've been planning. It's like, well, if there wasn't this rumor of Apple's tags that we believe in, then I'd just buy tiles. but I'm not, because we still believe.
And what's weird about the Apple tile is we've seen loads of software evidence.
Yeah.
But we haven't really seen any hardware supply chain side evidence. Like Quo hasn't talked about it very much, really. So, and we haven't seen any, you know, like on leaks or just random Chinese, oh, here's what it is and they're in production and stuff. So it is a bit weird what the state of that is. Like, you'd feel like if it was coming out for the Christmas period, holiday period, we might have heard something more concrete by now, like to go along with the software findings that clearly show that it, you know, is in development.
Yeah. I wonder if there's something about it just being such a small accessory, not even like physically sized, but just in terms of, you know, how many they plan to make at launch. Yeah. If it's more like an adapter, you know, type of market. But yeah, I guess we'll see. Let's talk about something that does seem imminent. Will you agree on that? That this the 16th MacBook Pro seems imminent?
I believe there will be some revision to the MacBook Pro very, very soon.
Yeah, prior to this week or so, we would have had much more excitement about this. But there was, I think it was the French Apple blog, Mac Generation,
yeah.
Yeah, that first published this icon that, frankly... We saw this and a week prior, and just at a glance, it, you know, based on like the glance at it without a comparison to the 15-inch version and like the identifier name, it just seemed like this wasn't a new machine and we just didn't scrutinize it enough. But a week later, Mac Generation published it and they did a thorough job of showing this is the 15-inch icon in Mac OS that shows this sort of generic MacBook Pro. And then this new one that now clearly shows, you know, the rumored 16-inch MacBook Pro with...
Well, I don't know if it clearly shows the rumored 16-inch MacBook Pro.
Well...
It shows a different MacBook Pro.
Don't you recall, though, like whenever the 16-inch MacBook Pro was rumored first from Ming-Chi Kuo, that like we had this whole thing about... Is it redesigned? Is Kuo saying redesign?
Yeah.
Like, and I think I was more like, I'm not sure Kuo's saying that, and you were like, no, it's in the text.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, kind of seems like it's taking back. Ticking back over to just a new entry in the existing family. I was swayed by your argument at the time. I recall that it is sort of this is how long Apple goes in between designs, and we are due for a new design. They begin at the top of the line sometimes and then they bring it down to smaller screen versions of that.
Yeah, and the way Kuo described it sounded more significant because he's pretty standard in the way he talks about stuff like processor updates versus something more substantial. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, if you go back and look at that Kuo report, you probably could make it line up with what this icon shows as well, because it is a new design. It's just a minor new design versus what we were kind of like hoping for in our heads, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if I recall back, it was like, I would consider at the time, like the Max version of the iPhone, a new design, even though it's the same design. It's a new version of the product. But I was swayed by the argument that they are due for a redesign and there's so many reasons to do that anyway. But I was fooled by this. At first glance, I was convinced this was the old one, and I just didn't do the level of comparison required.
Yeah, the due diligence to actually.
Yeah, see, there are some very minor changes that make this look like it's what's rumored. Like, you wouldn't look at it and say, oh, that's a 16-inch MacBook. But connecting the rumors with this image, with the comparison to the 15-inch version, it's different. I mean, the MacBook Pro shown, like you glance at it and the bezels are slimmer. They don't look super modern because it's still got a lot of area below the screen and above it. The sides are narrow. You know, it's got squared corners, so there's no change there. The base of the MacBook Pro appears the same style, at least. It's just more space between like the edges. I guess the speaker grill area would be larger, but the keyboard, you know, they do the same size keyboard, whether it's 13-inch or 15-inch, and this appears to be the same, that 16-point whatever it is, they've got the same keyboard on all three models. It's just the base is bigger around the aluminum part. Trackpad, like key layout and everything, the only difference that people have spotted really is that if you kind of zoom way in, you can analyze some difference where the touch bar is, that the touch bar seems to be just narrower, you know, by the width of like one key on either side.
Yeah, because now you've got presumably a physical escape key on the left, and then the power button on the right is separated, because on the current touch bar, they try and make it look like one continuous strip.
It's probably more like the MacBook Air now, where the MacBook Air has a key for Touch ID and power, just like the Touch Bar, but it's a key shaped.
Yeah, and I think the current design of the Touch Bar actually confused people because it's hard to even tell that the far right hand side is actually a button. If you know what I mean, like it does not. It doesn't look like a key that you can strike. So I reckon they had a lot of confusion about that, especially as the 2016 generation was the generation that started making it so like the laptop ultimately turns on when you open the lid and stuff. Remember, they started changing those behaviors.
Yeah.
So you don't even need to really know where the power button is unless you need to like force shut it down. But I think people would probably struggle to find, oh, that's actually where the Touch ID sensor is. That actually is the power button. And it's not just a thing that you lay your finger on. It's actually something you can press. And on this new design, obviously, it looks like a standalone key. It looks much more like, you know, a home button that you can actually push down.
Yeah. I think initially, my reaction was just a lot less excitement about this because me and you are people who appreciate not just what these things can do, but how they look. Like, you know, we were really bored and kind of uninspired by the iPhone design whenever the 6 lived on to the 7. You know, you had 6, 6S, 7. Are we still going to do this again? You know, the 8 we just didn't have to bother with, but whenever the 10 design came about, we loved it and we still do. I think that's kind of the feeling for this MacBook generation is that you could change some things about it to make it feel more modern, that there's some things happening with Windows laptops that it's confusing why Apple hasn't done themselves.
Yeah, it's a perfect corollary to the iPhone situation because right around the iPhone 7 timeframe, all the Android phones had started the quest of making the bezels thinner and slimmer. They weren't to the level that they are today, but they were closer than the iPhone was because the iPhone still had massive forehead and chins because it had that like equidistant home button gap right on both sides.
Yeah,
and it just looked unwieldy, especially with the at that time the what they call the plus size phones, right? The even bigger ones. It was like you've got this 5.5 inch phone, and then you've got like a 2.5 inch bezel on the top and the bottom, and you could compare it to Android phones that are frankly cheaper. And they would have even thinner bezels at that time.
Yep.
And so the 7, it was a fine phone, but it definitely wasn't like leading the design space, really. It was just trading on the classic, this is what an iPhone looks like.
I mean, Samsung was cutting bezel slightly every year, and Apple was leading it exactly the same. And then this gigantic leap, you know, with one generation. But
yeah, and we weren't expecting like an iPhone 10 when the iPhone 7 was out. But, you know, you'd want something that was... You don't want like a harsh juncture. You want more of a smooth, oh, okay, we can see this year the bezels have got this size and then the bezels have got this size, right? Because that's what the rest of the industry are doing, and Apple was basically just sitting on its laurels being like, you know, we don't need to bother with that stuff. And then you look at the MacBook Pro design compared to Windows laptops, including like Huawei and all, you know, all the Chinese manufacturers, they basically cloned the MacBook Pro in every single way, apart from the fact the bezels are smaller, because they can do that and they have a bigger screen in the same physical space. And then you have the MacBook Pro, which is 15 inches, and it's got, you know, big bezels on the side, and you compare it to this clone laptop, which should be inferior because, you know, it's not the real deal, and it has a bigger screen with thinner bezels and it looks more modern. And if you compare this icon with the icon for the current laptops, this one looks physically bigger because, you know, before the whole idea was, oh, they're going to have the bezel so thin, then it can be the same physical size as the current 15-inch, and you'll just get a 16-inch screen for free. If you actually compare these side by side, it is noticeably taller.
Yes. So it's not what they did.
No. They didn't even do, like, rounded corners on the screen. I mean, obviously, this is under the assumption that this icon is representative, but... it seems like it is representative, but like, unfortunately, I think this is what we're gonna get.
I think this is
between now and Christmas.
Yeah, this isn't like intentional expectation setting, although it has existed for at least two beta versions of macOS 10.15.1. Beta 3 of that version came out today, and I haven't looked to see if it's still there or not. But this certainly managed my expectations that, event or not, if there's a new MacBook Pro this month, it's not a radical new generation. It's a higher end version of the current family, you know.
This icon took my expectations for the MacBook Pro from, oh, this is definitely going to need stage time because they're going to want to show it off and all its beauty, to, yes, oh, they're just going to do a press release for it. Like, it's a press release update. I don't know if that's a harsh way to describe it, but I think it's fair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
And obviously, what we can only see is the screen that's basically identical, but a bit bigger and slightly thinner on the sides. And we can see the touch bar change with the physical escape key, which will make people happy. Mm-hmm. You can't really see, obviously, whether the other parts of the keyboard have changed. I know some people want to go back to T-shaped arrow keys. You can't really say for sure on this one whether it's changed or not. And obviously, this render isn't high fidelity enough to be able to go, oh, it's not a scissors, you know, it's not a butterfly key right. design anymore. And we're all expected to be scissor key designs. But me personally, you know, I've been living with the 2016 MacBook Pro all this time, and I was like, okay, Apple, next time you redesign it, I'll come and we'll go along for the ride. I don't want to shell out, you know, £2,000-£3,000 for what is essentially just a fixed version of what I bought in 2016. Mm-hmm. That just feels completely wrong. So in my head with this time, it's like, okay, yes, it will be fixed, but also I'll be buying something new, right? And it'll be a different design. It'll be a different direction. And we're certainly not getting good indicators on that basis. Maybe they've changed the I/O situation for people that want SD cards or extra ports or all that sort of stuff. Obviously, this is just a face-on view, mm-hmm. but the general chassis of the laptop is the same as what we've known since 2016.
Yeah, that's the part that is now is interesting. Now that this part has been sort of spoiled from Apple's leak here, is we don't know what the back looks like or the sides look like, especially where the ports are. So right now on a 15-inch MacBook Pro, you get one headphone jack and then you get two Thunderbolt 3 ports on either side, so four total. And that's it. And that's the same as a 13-inch MacBook Pro. Yeah, looking at mine. Yeah, exactly the same there. So there's no benefit in I/O from one 13 to one 15. 16, maybe they can pull it off. it's not that there's not space for it. I think it's what is the chipset inside that can drive these the amount of ports.
Yeah, there's like restrictions on how many PCI lanes are inside.
Yeah.
So it's basically impossible for them to be able to have like six Thunderbolt 3 ports. Mm-hmm. If they wanted to break the symmetry of all these ports do the same thing, there would be bandwidth for having, you know, the same four Thunderbolt ports that we know today, plus two USB-C ports that are just normal USB and not Thunderbolt, right? Mm-hmm. So they could do that. And that would actually be very useful from a practical perspective, because a lot of the time what you're plugging in, like a keyboard, or you're plugging in a mouse, or you're plugging in a USB-C hard drive that's not an SSD, it's just an old spinning one, and mm-hmm. those kind of accessories don't need Thunderbolt 3 bandwidth, so just being able to plug it in and then having the extra ports available would be, you know, very, very beneficial. Then it's uglier in terms of the product description, because it's like, now you've got four Thunderbolt ports and two USB.
You put the little icon for the lightning bolt next to the Thunderbolt port, and then, you know, you've got a good indicator of what they are, at least, you know.
Yeah, but I personally wouldn't expect that to happen.
No.
I think the ports are going to stay the same.
You think it's going to be two on either side?
Yeah.
So that's a good expectation if you don't want to be disappointed by this machine. Like me personally, I know if you don't use an SD card reader, then you don't care that it isn't there. But for me, that's one of the things that when I see a 15-inch or a 13-inch MacBook Pro from 2012 era in the wild, or like 2015 when they were the last, you know, new version was introduced, that's the one thing I see and look, oh, that's nice. It's never HDMI was never use that, and it's all about what you use. But that's why Apple loves their new laptops, is because all the ports are the same and you can do whatever with them through adapters or the right cord. But for me, SD card is a big one, because you just take the SD card out of your camera and you put it in the machine. No cable or adapter required. And I hated the whole "it's cumbersome" line from Phil Schiller whenever he was asked about, like, why did you do that? And it was like something like, it's cumbersome to handle SD cards. It's like, it's cumbersome to have an adapter dedicated just for moving this over. And there's things like wireless transfer, but it's just – there are always limitations to that, and if you've got a pro machine, then it feels like it's expected to be there.
Yeah, and like these are the machines targeted at video editing,
yes,
photo editors, exactly. Yeah. It's not like the lower end models; it's the top of the range. We even expect this 16-inch MacBook Pro to be more expensive than what the current prices top out at. Like,
yeah.
So if you want to cater to the professional audiences, having stuff like HDMI and SD cards just on the laptop is very welcomed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you had those, that would be a pretty big deal, you know, in terms of I/O. If you have the same four Thunderbolt 3 ports on either side, you know, two on either side, but then you've also got HDMI and SD, or even just SD, like
yeah, I think HDMI is dead.
Me too.
Eyes. There's no way they're gonna do HDMI. Like you can do display, you can do higher resolution display output through the Thunderbolt 3 ports.
Well, and HDMI is kind of. It's TVs, but there's plenty of HDMI to USB-C cables. So either way, it's a cable, and then
obviously they're doing AirPlay on all the smart TVs now. So you've got wireless options,
and there's USB-C monitors, and
yeah. I think HDMI is like donezo, but yeah. SD card, I'd say is plausible.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't bet on it. But I wouldn't be like, no, that's not happening.
Yeah.
And full stop.
My interest in this would spike way high if it had one, just out of pure convenience. Like the iMac Pro has one, and I love it. And I'll often, like, even if I'm working on the Mac Pro, I'll go back into my office and put the SD card in the iMac just to, like, do, like, a direct import, you know, without having to find an adapter. So another thing I wonder that you really can't tell from this, you know, I mean, there's a few things. Like, we don't know what processors it will use. Like what the screen brightness will be. The resolution's been rumored, but it's not really revealed by this image.
Doesn't look like Face ID.
No. Well, you know.
I mean, that's the comparison in my head. It's always like, this is the MacBook Pro, and then you look at what they offer in the $999 or $799 even iPad Pro.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't feel like they've kept in lockstep at all. The MacBook Pro is dated in comparison to what the iPad Pro can offer you.
Yeah, but I do wonder, like, if a bigger machine affords them more battery life, or if it's just about power. You know, you just get a beefier processor and some beefier specs. The keyboard will be a big deal, obviously. Like I've gone all this time with different MacBooks. Like you've had the same one since 2016. I had that one.
Yeah, the worst original version.
Yeah. After the first update, I felt like, oh, I bought it too soon. But then they've kept doing these like iteration updates that have not been a big deal. So I lost that feeling pretty quickly, even if I did get different MacBooks along the way. But I went all that time without having a serious keyboard issue that couldn't be like cleaned, you know, with just rubbing the keys real hard. But now for months, though, I've had this like I keyboard problem where I'm typing and the letter I just repeats, even if it isn't like I can tell you like IP and it'll type like IPI sometimes, not just like IIP. And it's so consistent that now like if it's just a message to somebody, you know, over iMessage, I just leave it. Or if it's in Slack, I just leave it. Sometimes on a tweet, just leave it.
I mean, you know, my B key's been busted for ages.
Yeah, so it's
just I'm always typing multiple Bs when I only want one.
Yeah, I'm glad I don't have an I on my password.
And my name's Benjamin.
Benjamin. There's no I on my password, so I don't feel it that way like you do. But that's just a matter of I need to have this thing sent off and have it replaced and have the clock reset on and out, I guess. But that is certainly an interesting thing about this machine that if they, you know, as rumored, go from butterfly switches to scissor switches and that alleviates the problem. Like it would be bad if they ruined scissor switches too by limiting travel. Even if it's greater travel, if it's like not a certain threshold and they have issues there too, that wouldn't be great. But we think this will be good. We'll see. But even besides all of that, like there are initial complaints that I had with the first MacBook Pro with Touch Bar in 2016. And I think these have been true for a lot of people, which is when you look at the Touch Bar, it's Retina, but it looks kind of fuzzy. And, so I wonder if they've never improved Touch Bar from the first version of it. Even something like haptic feedback from it would be cool. And they've not done that in the 3 years since it's been introduced. So if this is like the first, if they made a smaller, if they made a 15-inch or 13-inch MacBook with slimmer bezels and they saw that this is like the first version of the next generation, it's just a very minor change. Because we do expect this keyboard to come to the other MacBooks, including the Air. Then I wonder if they would also improve Touch Bar. And that seems like a small enough, it wouldn't be in the rumors. But it's I only mentioned it because I think it's been something missing since the first version and a complaint people had with the first version in 2016 that hasn't been addressed yet. Like, even though it's high resolution, it looks fuzzy. It doesn't look as sharp as the screen. and there's no haptic feedback to it, so it feels kind of weird to use. So if they could make some minor changes to it, it would be more than they've done so far.
Yep, that would be nice. If you are still using one of the big wireless providers in 2019, have you asked yourself what exactly it is that you're paying for? Between retail stores, inflated prices, and hidden fees, it all just adds up. Enter Mint Mobile. Mint Mobile provides the same premium network coverage at a fraction of the cost because everything is done online. Mint Mobile saves on the overhead of retail locations and passes those savings on to you. Mint Mobile makes it super easy to cut your wireless bill down, starting at $15 a month. Every plan comes with unlimited nationwide talk and text. And you can stop paying for unlimited data that you'll never use. You can choose plans with 3, 8, or 12 gigabytes of 4G LTE data. Now, Zach's been trying out a Mint Mobile SIM for a little while now.
Yeah, the service with Mint Mobile is terrific. And the overall experience with just being able to manage how much data you need and know how much you're paying every month is really great. You can see how much data is left from the app or from the web. And it's really no complaints here. It's all good for Mint Mobile.
Keep your same phone and phone number. Ditch your old wireless bill and start saving with Mint Mobile. To get your new wireless plan starting at $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/happyhour. That's mintmobile.com/happyhour. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/happyhour today.
All right, and tell me about the macOS Catalina supplemental update to the update.
Yeah, this was a ride. We spoke about installing macOS Catalina for the first time a couple of episodes ago. I said it went pretty smoothly, didn't really have any big issues, was fine. It was like, whatever, okay, I've got Catalina now. And then they come out with this supplemental update, which apparently has a few different fixes, but it's not enough of an update for it to be the point one. It's just called macOS 10.15 supplemental update. And they've done supplemental updates, you know, every year or so, whatever. They just come in and out. And I've never even thought of it twice. It's like, okay, supplemental update, whatever. It's fine. It's just going to change some small little things, fix some bugs, and we'll be on with the day. The first time in ever owning the Mac, this supplemental update just completely ruined my laptop. I don't know what went wrong, but I installed the supplemental update, and then my external display would never connect again. It just wouldn't see my external display. I was stuck on a 15-inch screen the whole time, and then I rebooted it, and then I couldn't even launch applications. I looked Safari, I'd go on a website, it would crash. I launched Chrome, I navigated somewhere, it would crash. I'd open Photos, it would show me my grid, but as soon as I clicked on a picture, it would crash. Like, I don't know, it was just the weirdest thing in the world. Like, the laptop was completely gone. I could barely do anything on it. I posted a story in the morning, and we have to make obviously the header images. I couldn't open Pixelmator to make the header image. It just would not. I could not get it to reliably open. I had to go to Google and fingers crossed that Safari wouldn't crash and find an online photo editor just so I could crop this picture. It was the most annoying thing in the entire world. And so I don't know what went wrong, but it was the worst supplemental update experience I've ever had. I threw caution to the wind. I ordered a cable to make my screen work again because I thought, oh, it's getting confused about the Thunderbolt 3 dock that I use. So I ordered a cable overnight. And then I also tried, but the app launcher thing, I just couldn't use the computer. So I was like, okay, I'm going to have to go to a backup or something. And so ideally, you know, if you can fix a problem without having to go to a backup, then it's better than doing it. You should always have backups in case you need it. But I thought, okay, I'll try recovery mode first. So I did Command R, rebooted the computer. In recovery mode, it immediately connected to the external display again. I was like, ooh. Obviously, you can't really do anything in recovery mode apart from, you know, reinstall stuff. But I was like, okay, it's not completely bored because the screen is actually live and working. So what I did is I did a reinstall of macOS. And based on my Twitter feedback, a lot of people don't know how this works. Reinstalling macOS from recovery mode does not overwrite your data. It preserves your home folder and some other folders. It only basically changes like the system stuff, and it will do like a diff and then download whatever needs replacing and switch it out. So it's less disruptive than like formatting the drive and starting from scratch with the Time Machine backup or something. So I was like, okay, I'll try that first. It took a little while. It rebooted and everything was back to normal. I don't know what happened. I don't know why it went crazy and just broke down, but my screen was working again. My apps would launch and I've been on that situation ever since then. And I didn't lose any of my data or anything. I didn't have any weirdness I had to sort out. It just worked as normal. And so that supplemental update somehow messed me up, but I managed to get back on track just by reinstalling it. And then when I did reinstall it, I was like, it's going to ask me to install the supplemental update again.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've reinstalled to, you know, 10.15.0. But apparently that's not how it worked. It's never offered to update to install the supplemental update. So I think I've skated by. And rather amusingly, about 2 days later, Apple actually re-released the supplemental update with no description about why they were re-releasing it. But maybe my situation was not an isolated incident.
Did you try blowing in air in the keyboard at a 45 degree angle? Could have been it.
I've never seen my computer break in that way ever before in any situation.
Yeah.
It was wild.
See, you got to live on the beta because then you don't get these problems. You know, the beta is the real version of the release.
Clearly.
Yep. All right. Let's mention briefly the situation with macOS Catalina and all of the privacy dialogues that pop up upon first installation and first run of each app. We've had some time to live with this. How are you feeling?
Yeah, we didn't get to this when we first talked about Catalina. It just didn't come up on our radar. But I'm glad we've like waited a couple of weeks because it definitely annoyed me when I first updated and you got flooded with like 10 apps asking for permission to send you notifications at the same time, the same 10 apps you've been using, you know, for the last 5 years of macOS. And then every time you'd have to do something, it'd ask you for folder permissions. I'd open like my code editor and it asked me for permission to access my documents folder. Then it would ask me permission to access my desktop folder. Then it was asking me to access permission to the network folder. And like all of that was completely ridiculous. And they should definitely have a policy where these notifications don't come into your face all at once, or they're merged together, and so you only have to press to accept one time unless you want to customize things individually. That being said, a fortnight on, it basically doesn't affect me at all because I've accepted everything now, and I never really get prompted with anything apart from occasionally if you download a new app or something. Like it was an annoyance on the upgrade process, and it definitely should have been designed better. But in terms of day to day usage, they never pop up again, so I guess I'm fine if that makes sense.
I'm afraid that that's what the people who designed this feel too, is that it's just a one time thing and then you're over it. And
it's such a bad one time thing,
though. But right, yeah, and it's not just a one time thing. Like there's so many occasions where the solution to a problem is to reinstall macOS like from scratch. You know, like even I think the way that you did it, does that.
I did not actually get – I reinstalled from recovery mode and I did not get prompted to accept everything again.
That's a good sign. But if you do like nuke and pave and do a real – like erase everything and start over from scratch and just like migrate your data another way or just start over with data, then that's going to happen. If you do you know, like you migrate data from one Mac to another, I assume that won't make this happen. But if you buy a new Mac and you set it up from scratch and you just like move over some files selectively, which I think is a pretty common thing to do – then you'll face this again. you know, so I think it's still not great. You know, I think that's we all agree on that. And I've still seen these things pop up. Like if I try a new app, for example, like I find I need to do something on the Mac. It requires an app to do that. Let me try this app out to see if I even want to use it, if it's even the right tool for this problem. And then I get faced with like, the notification tool, all notification and things like that. It just drives me a little bit bananas each time. And it was kind of associating the Safari behavior with that whole system too, because now there's, you know, with Safari, like you'll have this isn't new to Catalina, but you'll have like websites asking for location. You'll have websites asking for permission to send notifications or do downloads. And I just associated all of these dialogue requests, permission requests with the Catalina stuff because they all feel the same. And even once I got past the Catalina stuff, I was still seeing like, oh, this is the first time I've used this website in Safari to download a file, and it's asking me for permission to allow it to do downloads. So I finally made the connection of like, okay, with Safari, you can at least go and say, like, with every website that you've visited, you see the permission that you've given it. And then you can, there's an option to say, when visiting other websites, allow for downloads, for example. And so I changed that from whatever the default is to allow, and now I never see that again. So that's a good ability, because I'm really going to download something by accident. And if I do, you know, I'll see where it went and I'll know what it is. But, and it's the same thing with like location and camera and microphone. So any ones of those, I can just like have it be like, yeah, I want to use the internet, then cool. It would be nice if that same thing was available, like you see from the website preferences for Safari, but for your whole system, where you see this is a list of every possibility, and where it isn't like, I mean, the common sense solution is that when you launch an app for the first time, you see everything it can possibly request, and then you get to give it permission selectively or for everything, sort of like with HealthKit on iOS. But even beyond that, like, that would still be for every app. It wouldn't be so bad if you just got to go through each permission example on and just preferences and say, I will always allow an app to access the desktop, you know,
folder. Set the default that always applies.
Right. So that you effectively, you do one opt-in for every permission, and then you go back to the way it used to work. And that's still like an opt-in thing manually that you've got to know about, but it's useful. Because even though, like, you kind of get through the initial setup process with Catalina and all the apps that you've been allowing to do things like send notifications, and now they're asking you for permission because your OS has changed. I've still seen things like, if I'm using the Forecast app to format, do MP3 encoding on the podcast file, there was a permission for the downloads folder to save there. There was another one for the desktop folder, and those hit me on different weeks. And it's like, aren't those feel the same to me? You know,
I don't know why they differentiate by like individual folders. They should just say your entire home folder, please allow.
Yeah. So, and this is with running betas all summer long. And so it's more than just a few weeks, just like a few months. And I'm still hitting those occasionally, you know, more than I would like to. And it's always just like, didn't expect that. I thought it was going to be instant. And I've with Safari especially, I mean, this is separate from Catalina, but what I was picking up on was I would download a file, change the tab or the app I was in, go to look for the file later, and it wasn't there, only to realize, oh, it's still a modal pop-up within Safari that I've got to go back and like address before it will download instantly after that. And I just assumed it was like a slow download or something. So once I fixed Safari, I was much happier, but I'm still seeing them. Like, I downloaded a brand new app today on the Mac, and I had to go through all of that. And it's the thing, like, the app that I was using doesn't really have anything to do with notifications, but maybe there's like an alert that it can give you. And so to have a pop-up asking for notification permission was kind of annoying, you know, and who knows what else will pop up as I actually start using the app. But it's like that won't go away even after day one, because it's day one all over again with each new app, and especially if you buy a new Mac and set it up from scratch.
The new Mac setup is unacceptable. We've all read some surprising online reviews. Whether you're trying to get a sweet deal on something you've been saving for, or trying to find the best happy hour in town, it's generally a good idea to read the reviews first. So why should finding the right software for your business be any different? Read thousands of real software reviews and find the right software for your business at Captera.com/happy hour. Not familiar with a Captera? Captera is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 1 million reviews of products from real software users, discover everything you need to make an informed decision. Search more than 700 specific categories, covering the entire range of business needs, from project management to email marketing, to even running your own yoga studio. No matter what kind of software you're looking for to get your business off the ground, or to simply optimize existing workflows, Captera makes it easy to discover the right solution and fast. How'd you get started? Go to Captera.com and drill down into a subcategory like app design, home building, insurance, or banking. It's completely free to look around and explore what's available. Don't trawl the web with endless Google searches. Captera brings everything together into one simple-to-browse directory. Join the millions of people who use Captera each month to find the right tools for their business. Visit captera.com/happyhour for free today. Find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Captera.com/happyhour. Captera, CAPTERRA.com/happyhour. Captera, software selection simplified.
All right, Mayo, I want to do another bit on the Mac this week. Just to continue our Mac coverage on the 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour podcast. Specifically about Catalyst apps and if we found any of these Mac Catalyst apps that we enjoy that we're actually using now that it's not just a theoretical, but it's a reality. So I know that you have a great affection for Catalyst apps. So before we get to your great enthusiasm, I will kick it off with just some mild commentary. But to start off with, there's an app that I'm really enjoying called Calory, which is spelled C-A-L-O-R-Y. And it started off on the iPhone and the iPad. And it's just a really good-looking, like, Apple design language calorie tracker that works with HealthKit so that you get your calorie tracked from food saved into the Health app. And then any app that uses HealthKit as a database can read or, you know, read that. And it's really nice looking and useful. And there's an Apple Watch app, so you can quick add your calories from the iPhone or the iPad or the Apple Watch. And I started using it before Catalina came out. And then I found out that they had a beta version for the Mac, and I tried that out. And then now it's officially out now that Catalina is here. And I'm using Calory to just input manually or scan like a barcode and then, you know, save calories from that if it's in the database to replace MyFitnessPal with a much more like reliable sync and a better looking app. And I enjoyed it on the iPhone and the iPad and the Apple Watch, but having it on the Mac where I work, you know, during like, it's kind of like my breakfast and my lunch hours, really. Is really useful because it's on my MacBook Pro wherever I am as an app, and it's on my iMac Pro in the office. And just having like that one less piece of friction, like if I remember, oh, I just had lunch and it's this, then I can open up Calory on the Mac and just like put it in really quickly and save it. And it's not a bad Mac Catalyst app as like far as a ported app from the iPad goes. It kind of reminds me like the design and feel of it. Like whenever you remember the mail app Mailbox?
Yes.
And it was like before Mac Catalyst, and they had a very iOS looking Mac app for their, you know, Mac version of their iOS app. And it kind of reminds me of that in that it's like, it's clearly not like a Mac app designed from scratch for the Mac, but it gets the job done with what I want to do with it. So the utility is there. And because it's a nice looking app on the iPad, it carries over that it's a friendly app to use and not clunky on the Mac. There are some like weirdnesses about it. Like, I've given some feedback about how keyboard shortcuts I think should work. And, it is a really like motion, responsive, interactive feature on mobile devices that the Mac doesn't have. And so it's replicated through like clicks and stuff. So there's some of like the whimsy can't be there, but a lot of it is. And it's also just useful because like with MyFitnessPal, I would use the website and the sync from the web to the app using the same like, you know, sync server was unreliable and the website was terrible. And so having a Mac app for all this stuff, you know, is really cool. So I'm enjoying Calory. I'll also say that with the Twitter app on the Mac, I didn't even try that until like a week after it came out. Again, this is like the version from the iPad, but it's on the Mac, and there's not a whole lot of utility there for me because there's no streaming where the timeline refreshes as new tweets fill in automatically without needing to refresh it. And so that's not useful for me. So I'm still using TweetDeck for my Mac Twitter client, but I do have it installed just to try it out. And what I found to be, you know, kind of useful is that it deep links from the website in a way that like if you click a tweet URL from the web, it will open the Twitter app. And then you have like the app experience, which is
Universal Links, it's called.
Yeah, Universal Links. Yeah. So it's a little, it can't be nicer. That can also be jarring if you expect it to open like in a Safari tab. And I found, you know, how like a tweet bot or tweet deck is like a big web app and a wrapper. And so if I click on someone's profile in tweet deck and click their avatar, like their image, it will open in a Twitter app, which is weird when I just expect to have like a bigger picture of their image pop up. So there's some weirdness there. I'm also getting like notifications both from TweetDeck and the Twitter app, even when the Twitter app isn't open, which is cool, like for Twitter notifications. But, you know, I guess you've also get like the share sheet, you know, where you can like tweet a photo from Photos or a link from Safari. That's cool to have, but, until it gets streaming, it won't really replace TweetDeck for me. And I'm also kind of all in on having a bunch of columns now. So it would need, you know, really good column support too. But eventually I could see this evolving into an app that I use, because there's still a lot of hangups with TweetDeck where keyboard shortcuts don't work the way I want them to. And just not being a, you know, even as native as Catalyst is, then it's, you know, it's a mixed bag. What about you in Catalyst apps?
Yeah, I think what you just said on both Calendly and Twitter for Mac is a great, you know, great summary of the situation. It's you have like the bottom of the pile, which is nothing at all, and your only option is to go through a web browser. Then you have a little bit up from that. You've got your web apps in a wrapper like TweetDeck, and it's imminently clear the moment you launch any of these apps that these are web apps in a wrapper. Like, you just know it. You don't have to be a developer. You can just tell that the app was not designed for the Mac. And then, you know, several rungs above that, you then have the Catalyst situation, which again, I think most people can, even if they couldn't like pinpoint exactly what framework it is or what it's called, I think you can generally tell, oh, this app was not made like these other apps on my Mac. This came from somewhere else. And you said like Calendly, like it, you know, for all its good or bad parts, it looks like an iOS app, right? Mm-hmm. And that is completely true. It's great that some of these apps exist. The Calendly wouldn't exist without something like Catalyst, because it'd just be too much effort to maintain. Twitter for Mac, we saw them get rid of the native Twitter for Mac because they couldn't keep up with it.
They got rid of paying Black Pixel to make an app for them. Like, they didn't have to have anyone on staff. They outsourced it to a contractor and they got rid of that.
Yeah, and that very quickly fell behind on features and functionality, right? Even when it was quote unquote around, it wasn't kept up to date with polls or, you know, the streaming stuff or the latest mentions, the latest Twitter features. It was just left to starve. And at least with Twitter for Mac, the Catalyst version, the sharing that is possible between their iOS codebase and their Mac codebase means that it should at least not be left behind too much, and it should stay around. And the Twitter for Mac experience is better than what Twitter for iPad offers. Like, there's less of just massive white columns of space, although if you go wide enough, it still happens.
Yeah.
Twitter for Mac was like, okay, I tried it out. I found scrolling performance to be pretty poor, just like scrolling the timeline and stuff. Especially even compared to TweetDeck, which is, you know, the web app in the wrapper, the WebKit implementation just seemed a lot smoother. I'm sure some of that they can just work on in, you know, bug fix releases, and maybe Apple can do some updates to the platform side of Catalyst as well to help with some of that. It was okay. It was definitely like, I think it's good that it's there, because if you're just thinking of like an average, a user that has an iPhone for their entire life, and then they buy a Mac, they're like, I love Apple, right? I'm getting my Mac. I've been on a Windows computer through, you know, high school, and now I'm on my own. I can buy a Mac of my own. And then they go and find apps that they recognize from their phone and they just didn't exist before. Catalyst helps to patch up a lot of those experiences and give mediocre to okay native applications that at least match in terms of feature set, if not in terms of design and platform nativeness, right? The best Catalyst apps that I've seen are the ones that go through loads of hoops to basically import parts of AppKit and recreate parts of AppKit inside the Catalyst experience, which is technically unsupported, but Apple's kind of just turning a blind eye to it at the moment, and they're just letting the apps go on the store anyway. And yes, they're better. They're still not as good as, you know, raw apps designed from the ground up specifically for the Mac. But as we've established just by looking at the course of the historical timeline, very, 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 very few companies want to have or care to or invest in an app of that nature. So you know, in the absence of nothing, it's always going to be better. But the Catalyst apps are about as good or about as bad as I expected them to be, just as you can, you know, which it just depends which side of the coin you're looking at, right? Like, are they as good as native Mac apps? No. Would I be upset if all of my apps that existed on the Mac today just transformed into the iOS versions through Catalyst? Yes, I would be. But like what you're mentioning, Twitter for Mac, it was removed completely and didn't exist, and now it's back. Calorie wasn't on the map before, and now it's back. And I will say that the third-party attempts with Catalyst are much better than Apple's example in, like, the Home app or the News app. Like, you know, the third-party developers are kind of showing Apple to shame in that, in a way. I released, as a bit of an experiment, a Bingo machine, which is, you know, quite popular on the iPhone. I released that on the Mac just to see how it would be. It was quite simple to get up and running with, like, touch bar integration and keyboard shortcuts and menu bar and stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, it's not hard to see that it's an iPad app running in a window, right? And that's fine. Bingo machine wouldn't have never existed on the Mac without Catalyst. Now it's there. It's cool, and it was fun to do, and I definitely would have never set aside development resources to do, like, an AppKit version. But I wouldn't, like, herald it as incredible software. Well, you can tell that
for
it's
you
not-
wasn't the tab to link utility that you created, like, wasn't that a big learning process from
And that was a fully AppKit app, but it was still small scale, right? Because it's essentially just like a single window experience, and it did definitely get me up and running with understanding of how the AppKit world worked. But that wouldn't make it would still be a massive amount of time investment and to even replicate Bingo machine in the way that I'd want to, right? Like, just because basically I know how to do it now where I didn't before, but I also know that it's still going to take me longer than I'd want to on a platform that has questionable user base, right? Because, like, just because you make a Catalyst app and you put it on the Mac App Store, it doesn't mean people are going to download it. The Mac App Store's pitifully volumes of downloads compared to the iOS. It's just ridiculously different scales. So, and that's the number one reason why nobody does bother to invest in true AppKit apps, because the reality is most people don't get the apps, so it just doesn't happen. I hope that, you know, that over time Apple can improve the frameworks so that all these random workarounds and guessworks and gaps in functionality aren't necessary. Like, even for Bingo machine, I have a slider which is for the automatic timer, so the time between you can call balls, and it's supported from the iPhone, where it was like a slider in a circle, right? And you can just drag it around. Well, on the Mac, it makes sense to allow the user to be able to scroll with two fingers on their trackpad to be able to adjust it, rather than having to, like, drag around the circle, because, you know, it's not a direct interaction experience. But even something as simple as getting the scroll events to scroll on the trackpad, that requires a technically unsupported private API hack that, at the moment, Apple just kind of lets through, but realistically, that's not actually part of the Catalyst platform as they presented it with Catalina. So there are big areas and scopes of functionality where all apps can benefit once Apple improves the situation. But that could be, you know, we're probably waiting until 10.16 before anything meaningful comes out of that.
Yeah, and even today there was a story where CNET had some commentary from an Apple marketing person, I believe named Todd Benjamin, and he sort of gave a comment on Apple's early, you know, what they're seeing from Catalyst from developers and users. What's that?
Yeah, quote? Basically applauding what they've seen come to the Mac so far. Obviously saying it's good for developers and it's good for users, but also kind of half addressing the criticism of, you know, Catalyst being undocumented and having big gaping gaps in functionality. He said, "We're learning a ton from these early adopters and are planning additional resources and support to help them create amazing Mac experiences with Catalyst." So that's just like the PR line, right? We're going to make it better in the future. It doesn't commit to making it better anytime soon, in the same way that we heard over the summer about Craig Federighi about, oh, the, you know, the Marzipan apps haven't been tuned up yet, they'll be really much better, and then they turned out to be exactly the same. So I wouldn't put, like, too much stock in those words. Of course Apple knows where the bad bits of the Catalyst framework are. They, you know, they're not stupid. They know where the deficiencies are, and I'm sure there are people working on improving it, but looking at Apple's normal software development timelines, realistically, you're not going to see any meaningful improvements until June 2020, when they announced macOS 10.16.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Yeah. So that's this week in Catalyst. it will be another year before we have any updates here, we assume. I also want to talk a bit about HomeKit and some related things. Part of this is fueled by my recent purchase of a new home, and I've gone from renting houses and apartments over the years to finally owning my own home for the first time. And that's been fun because all of a sudden, where I used to have to like document how everything that I changed was before, so that when I moved out, I could change it back, like make sure all the wiring is the same way on a light switch and the thermostat and the lock is like identical. To now, it was the funnest thing where I could, we changed the thermostat, and instead of like taking pictures of the old wiring, we just threw out the old thing. I was like, we don't need that. Same way with the old lock, like we go from a smart lock, don't need the old one, you know, cool. So that's been something that I've been having to, I want to do it like all overnight, but I've got to plan it out. And realistically, I can't just like overhaul the home. I've got to do it when there's time, but, expect more HomeKit talk as this experience goes on. And the first thing I want to talk about with HomeKit this week is actually some HomeKit news that you covered. And I was jealous because you got this story. I saw it on Reddit a day before. As like one user saw this, but then you got like the full story in a form that you could actually publish. So tell me about the Natapmo weather station and HomeKit.
Yeah, so the weather station has existed for a long time, like since I think the first version came out in 2013. And it's like a little cylinder, and it can measure all sorts of statistics about the room. And it has sensors for outdoor and indoor as well. So it can do like CO2 level, air quality, humidity, temperature. And there are other things. So there, you can buy little additional modules that measure like noise level or rain and, you know, all sorts of like barometric pressure and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And these things exist in different forms in the HomeKit universe today. You have like the Eve degree, you know, the Eve home stuff, where they just the little temperature gauges and they expose it to HomeKit, and you can ask Siri to do it, or you can just look at it in the home app. But the Natapmo weather station has not supported HomeKit forever until literally this week. Mm-hmm. Natapmo have been a pretty good HomeKit partner in other areas with like their thermostats, and they're doing doorbell coming out late this year.
They've had indoor and outdoor cameras,
They do cameras. Yeah, exactly. And I believe they've committed to supporting the iCloud video recording stuff, so that would be cool. But the weather station was a notable not one that wasn't included until recently, and until literally this week. And so now what they've announced is that through a combination of hardware change and software updates, all weather stations released or manufactured in 2016 or later can now join the HomeKit world. And they have this really interesting blog post where they talk about why they couldn't do HomeKit up front, what they had to change on the software stack, what they had to change on the hardware stack, and basically they kept having to do all these different things. And finally, the hardware was solid as of the 2016 model, but it still took time for them to be able to get the software up to scratch, as well as managing all the other different accessories that they make. But the end result is now it's here and available, and they're back supporting a good few years of existing buyers, not just going forward with a new model. Mm-hmm. It's a really cool, I think it's probably the best like all-in-one home sensor thing there is, just because it has so much flexibility and so many different sensors that you can get, like humidity, temperature, CO2, indoor and outdoor air quality. You can attach little like beacon modules for different room data, and they have all these like add-on modules for even other information, including like rain and noise levels. What you get in the HomeKit experience, because obviously the HomeKit protocol only defines a certain list of different things that an accessory can support. Some of the things like noise decibels aren't supported by HomeKit at the moment, so you can't get to those through the home app or with Siri. But you get like the core functionality, and they've committed to supporting the other sensors through HomeKit over time as Apple updates the protocol to support it as well. So yeah, it's a really nice show of support for a kind of like a standout accessory that just hasn't been in the HomeKit world for a while. And obviously, I'm going to try one of these out, probably write about it as well. And obviously, as of iOS 13.2, it will be even better because you'll be able to ungroup the accessory so it won't be stuck into one cart, into one tile.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So, like you all have one I can try out and we can discuss on a future episode too. This has been on my radar. this has been on my radar or the station for a while. I believe people have used it with Homebridge to make compatible. You know, so you're
together.
Exactly. So you sort of you hack it together using like built-in plugins from other people on your own server, but that's not like, you know, official support. So now you get official support from NetAtmo. And I have used the Eve stuff where I get temperature and humidity on my front by my front door, which is very useful. And that was like the biggest complaint I had from group tiles with HomeKit and 13 is that becomes like a tile you have to interact with and not just glance at. So ungrouping is awesome. And then I've also got an Eve. I forget the names of these, but it's like weather room degree. They've got different names for these different things. But I've got an indoor one that also does air quality.
Yeah, I think that's called the Eve room because I had one of those at one point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And both of these are ones that you recharge with micro USB. I used to have the battery versions, but then the batteries die after so long and those aren't awesome. These are really cool, the ones that you recharge with micro USB. But those two things are cool. But the weather station, the reason that's interesting is because they've got this, you know, whereas like Eve is like an early adopter of HomeKit stuff and their little sensors are like small and you can put them anywhere. The weather station is neat because it integrates with a lot of third party stuff because like weather station is just pretty, the data you get from it is really useful. So people with weather stations can like share their weather data with neighborhoods. So if there's like one nearby you could see it even if you didn't have one. You know, optionally share it. Also, I think apps like Carrot Weather let you replace whatever the default weather data source is, whether it's dark sky or whatever else, and you can use your weather station to have your weather data there as an option. And I believe that also extends to like putting that on a complication through the Carrot Weather app on your Apple Watch. And that's what I really want to do is have like my hyperlocal weather as a complication on the watch as an option. I mean, like, there's always a benefit of having your current location because then when you go about town, it's you know, local. But if you're at home mostly and that's what you really care about, then that's a cool thing to have at a glance on your watch and, you know, specific to your neighborhood, not just your, you know, zip codes or however it's measured. So I'm looking forward to trying this too. And when I looked at it after the news, I saw what, you know, they've got the weather station main product, but then the other modules I believe are like rain measurement and wind speed, and you know, if you have one, you got to have them all. It's my opinion. So I think like you'll have the weather station to try out, and I'll have to add the other two sensors because I don't know if you're a weather nerd like I am, but I love this stuff. I can't tell you why, but it's just cool to have. I think.
Yeah, we're always freaking out about like the indoor temperature and stuff. So it'd be nice because we didn't have a. Unfortunately, we can't get our HomeKit thermostat because our heating's really weird. But so at least we can actually have like temperature gauges and stuff.
Sure, that's cool. Yeah. Yep. Also with HomeKit, so I want to share a bit about the process from moving from the old house to the new house. And I've done this a few times where I've moved and I've moved HomeKit with me. And the only difference this time is that it's permanent. So that's really useful. I'll write more about this in the future and bring it up more in the show as well. But the main thing is that in the past, I've erased like the home and started from scratch, and that's been a pain because there's so many things that you need to like Google how to reset them. So I'm not doing that this time. I did remove my Hue bridge, but I'm going to add it back, and then you just manage the lights from the bridge, and so that reflects in the home app. The Lutron bridge I kept over, and I'll just like reassign where light switches are, but. I sort of realized, like, in all my years experimenting with HomeKit, I think, like, since 2014 when the Hue lights came out for HomeKit, I've sort of been, like, you know, trying everything, but now I can see what sticks, and now that it's sort of a permanent installation, what I prioritize. And my approach is that for all of the wall light switches and ceiling fans, I want to have Lutron replace the wall switches, and not just like most of them, but all of them, so that there's no inconsistency. There will, like, I want every closet, hallway, bathroom, you know, outside light, kitchen light to be that same like flat switch with the buttons on it. So, mm-hmm. you know, even that way, there's no like this is a switch and this is you know, a flat button, because as long as they're all the same, I think there's less complaints there. So I'm going that route. And then that also eliminates the whole, like, the light needs to be on for you to be able to control it from the app thing that you get with Hue. And Lutron does make these wall plugs where you plug in a lamp. And I've never tried them before, but the way they work is that they've got buttons on the wall plug for on and off and dim. And they tell you which bulbs work with them. But I guess it delivers, like, enough power to change the brightness of the bulb, which I've never tried. But they're kind of expensive, like $50-$60 for that. And the way I'm thinking about this is if the plug is behind like a shelf or something, you know, where the lamp is sitting on, that's not really accessible. So then you've got to have the remote. But it's kind of interesting that you would still have that dimmer control with any bulb. The only thing I'm thinking about where I do want to use Hue, because I was thinking maybe I'll just go only have Lutron, zero Hue in the home. But there is some fun and novelty in like color changing lights for outside. So I've got a ton of Hue bulbs. It would be a shame to waste them. But so I'm thinking I'll do some colored Hue bulbs outside. We've got
and you always do fun stuff for like Halloween and Christmas and stuff like that.
Exactly. And there's some lamps that you know, like I got that Sonos IKEA speaker lamp. And that's a situation where you couldn't change the amount of power driven to the cable because the speaker requires all the power. Mm-hmm. And there is a knob for the lamp, but you couldn't get around. Only thing you could do is have like one of the LIFX branded bulbs or something like that, where it's a Bluetooth smart bulb with no bridge. But then there's no way to do on and off. And what I wanted to do is have it as close to like anyone can come in, control it however they want and not have an issue. That's trickier with lamps, but as long as there's like a remote present, then they'll, you know, you can make the connection. I've also prioritized like bringing my TV back on HomeKit, because for a while I wasn't using my Synology to run HomeBridge anymore. I had messed up something and didn't put it back together. And, it was cool to have my LG TV work with HomeKit without official support from LG. I've brought it back. It was really easy to do this time. I'll try and put a couple of links in the show notes for people that want to do this, because it's more complicated than I want to like write in an article for someone to follow. But I've done it enough times now that I can say like, click this link and make of it what you will, and then this one and then this one, and then you're good to go. You know.
Yeah, I did a kind of write up about it for when I did the IR Blaster thing.
Yeah.
I did like the HomeKit setup on the Synology as well. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you'd have to tweak the ending bit for the TV side versus the IR Blaster. But yeah,
we'll put both of those in the show notes. But I don't want to support it for anybody because it's over my head. I'm just like following guides myself, and I've managed to have like input source changing correctly, where you get the little dial slider.
That's cool.
In the home app. That's really useful. You can relabel that, like they're HDMI 1 through 4 by default. You can rename them in the home app, but it changes back to what they are after a certain period of time where the TV resets. But then I think if you rename them from like the home bridge side, then that would reflect over indefinitely. So I'm thinking about doing that, where it's like PlayStation, Switch, Apple TV, whatever else. Only thing I've not mastered is turning the TV off is it works great. Switching inputs works, but turning it on, I've not mastered. And I think it's worked before, but I think it's, you know, if you want to do like HDMI CEC and then like run the Apple TV through the soundbar and have, Dolby Atmos and all this stuff, like I think it's all kind of conflicting right now. So I've got everything but turning it on, but it is cool to say goodnight and have the TV go off. And I've got an automation for when the last person leaves home, turn the TV off if it's on, or even just saying to the HomePod, Siri, turn the TV off. And it's like instant. And I love that. I've also prioritized changing the door locks to be smart locks. And I've got to order some, I think Chamberlain makes some good ones. And there's some other companies. I know Apple.com has some good ones that you can buy. But this is the first time that I've been able to change the outside lock on the door, not just the inside, with like an August lock or a Friday lock. Now I can actually change the entire thing to have like a pin code on the outside. And even with that method, the bottom lock is still like a dumb, the bottom like knob is still like a dumb lock where it's got a key and a little knob on it. But my last place that I rented, it had just like a French knob for the bottom knob with no lock on it. It was just the deadbolt is the lock. And I actually like that even without a smart lock. So this time what I'm doing is I've ordered matching like French style bottom lock or bottom knobs for the door.
Okay, I see. Yeah.
And so there's no one can ever accidentally lock the bottom lock or, you know, have to manage that. It will just be the smart lock on the top. I don't know if there's any security risk in that, but it worked for the last place I rented. And I went to an Airbnb that I rented over the summer, and they had like tape over the lock to like, so nobody could do it because they wanted you to be able to use the keypad no matter what. And when we arrived at that, like whoever was last there did turn the lock on the thing, so we couldn't get in. and I've had to like research all the ways that these doorknobs come in, and you can find ones that have the lock on the outside and inside, or do what I did and find the ones that you can like push down and push in, or there's like another class that is like dummy knobs that don't jiggle at all. They're just like stiff and therefore like pushing in and out with no like click, I guess. So, but that's something that, I found the color and the look I like, but I didn't value, you know, I didn't like want to get like the most expensive one because it's just a door handle. And, yeah. You know, I've got to go through the whole house and do this kind of stuff. So,
I think cool like, though that you now got the flexibility to do that, whereas before you were like subject to the terms of.
Right. Yeah. It's really cool. The thermostat wasn't like, just in terms of like going from a house that's like my new house, but it's not HomeKit yet until I make it that way. I prioritize changing the thermostat from like the basic one to an Ecobee 4. And I think the Ecobee 4 Lite is the one that I recommend the most because there's no Alexa built into it and I don't use that at all. I just want the HomeKit parts to it. And so that's the one I've used and recommend the most. I wish Nest would work with HomeKit because it looks the best. My friend has a Nest thermostat and I just kind of, the design is definitely better. But it's not worth doing like a home bridge workaround in case you know, something breaks in the future. And having a HomeKit thermostat is really useful for me at least. And then just making the lights work with HomeKit. Like if you nail down, lights, locks, and if, you know, if you've got a garage door, like having that instead of locks is, pretty much equal. And then your thermostat, like those three things are get you pretty far in terms of like filling out your house with HomeKit stuff. So that's where I've began, and, you know, I will experiment with this further, but it's really cool now to be able to permanently change things and totally disregard like the old stuff. And a friend of mine has bought a new home recently too, and his is a quote unquote smart home. But it's not HomeKit, and it's not like Google Home, and it's not Alexa. So I don't know what it is, but he doesn't want to change anything to HomeKit. And his last house that he owned and sold was HomeKit stuff, you know, that I'd sort of like given to him over time. And this new one, it's all under warranty. It's a brand new home, so he doesn't want to change anything until it's out of warranty. But it's kind of like a dumb smart home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're stupid. Those like ones that are sold as smart homes, but they don't have any integration with the actual voice assistants that you want to use.
Yeah, I told him, like, maybe we can do some HomeBridge stuff there. But, I mean, and also I've played with, well, I've got a home, you know, HomePod stereo that I'm using in the bedroom for left and right. And then I've got a HomePod in the living room. And that covers sort of both sides of the house in terms of like Siri access. But I've also got AirPlay 2 speakers in the dining room, both of the kids' rooms, and in my office. The one in my office is like actually a stereo system with an Airport Express attached to it, and so it's that kind of AirPlay too. But being able to say play music everywhere from one of the HomePods or like AirPlay from your phone to everywhere is really cool. I do wish Apple would make a cheaper HomePod so that I can replace, you know, the different branded AirPlay 2 speakers with no Siri input in like the kids' room, the dining room. With actual HomePods with Siri input that aren't $300, and I may look
for 2020.
Exactly, and in the meantime, I might, you know, I've seen people buy, you know, refurbished or just like people selling their HomePods for a lot less, and that was when they were priced at, was it $249 or
$350?
$350, yeah. So now they're $300. So I kind of want to look at the market of seeing like what people are selling them for now, but I wouldn't want to pay like more than $200, if that, for this, you know. But yeah, so that's something I'm looking forward to if they make those. Not related to HomeKit, but just sort of a new house thing. We've mounted both of our TVs, and that is such a cool thing that I've never done before, but I've always been sort of jealous of. And so that makes everything look really cool. Like, I changed my Apple TV screensaver timeout period, or like sleep period, from whatever the default is to 5 hours. So often when I walk into the living room, the OLED TV is like mounted above the fireplace, and it's on like a screensaver where it's, you know, it's the aerial stuff where it goes from Earth to underwater to space. I'm just like, that is so pretty, you know? And we had, some neighborhood kids over to play with my daughter, and she was like, they're just like having fun doing whatever they wanted to do. And, the thing that they found themselves doing was playing Apple Arcade games on the Apple TV in the living room with a, you know, MFI controller. And it was Hot Lava that was sort of the game that got their attention. And the kid she had over playing was like, she asked the kid if he had Apple Arcade, because like she's so familiar with it now. And he was like, no, but I played this game on my PC like a year ago or something. And he was like really excited to play it on the TV.
Yeah, because Hot Lava was on like permanent beta on Steam on the Windows for a while.
Right.
So probably played it through that.
Yeah. And it was cool like watching them do arcade in the way that I envisioned it when it was announced. It was like, this will be a big hit with the kids. And seeing that turn in, you know, go from just like my daughter to her and her friends was like, yeah, that's worth $5 a month. So and then also not HomeKit related, but sort of like, you know, new house. I've taken the opportunity to refresh some of my my office accessories. So I've been using this all started a few months ago whenever I lost my the black Magic Mouse that Apple sells and includes with the iMac Pro. I could not find that it was like in Bluetooth range for months before it died. And it turned out that my 2-year-old son had like put it in my desk chair in a way that I couldn't see. And until he took it out, I didn't know where it was. But in the meantime, I had purchased the Logitech MX Master, MX 2S Master Mouse. I don't know. I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Close enough. But since then, and I was really happy with that too. And when I went back to the Magic Mouse, when he refound what he had lost, and I was like, oh, this really isn't as ergonomic as what I've been using. But they since came out with the MX 3, and it uses USB-C to recharge instead of micro USB. And, I got one to try out, and I really like this thing. Like, it's got some different buttons and different placements and everything, but it's got a lot of the same features as the previous one. But there's enough buttons on it that once you learn how to use it and customize it with the Logitech Options app on the Mac, then you can do all the things that you would do with gestures on a trackpad or the mouse, like bring up Mission Control or App Expose. Like one of the things that I found really cool about this is the side scroll wheel. When you're in Safari, you can silently go from tab to tab, left and right, without clicking at all. It's sort of like having a touch bar, but there's no touch bar involved. It's just your mouse, you know, and you're like going through the tab. So I found this to be very cool. And then because I was trying this out, I wanted to try out the keyboard equivalent of the Logitech MX 3, and it's called the Logitech MX Keys. And it's a Mac or PC keyboard. The bad part about it is that it's got the PC keys written on it on the same keys as like the Mac keys. So what I've done is I've taken Sharpie and written over the Windows parts. And
that's funny.
Yeah, even though I've got like a virtual machine of Windows, I don't want to ever see those. But it's backlit, and it's kind of cool to have a backlit keyboard with the Mac, and it's got a numpad and everything. But you know, and I don't have to have that, but it's the same like size and layout and everything as the Apple Magic keyboard with numpad that comes with the iMac Pro, but it's backlit and USB-C to recharge. So those are two cool things.
It's kind of weird that Apple hasn't done a backlit external keyboard yet.
Well, here's the thing. When you do backlit, it works a few ways, and you can change the brightness level of it, but it's like you don't have to click a key to turn on the backlit part of it. I think it kind of detects your motion. Like when you touch a key without clicking it. And so that's neat about it. But I think they only promise up to 10 hours of battery or 10 days of battery with backlit on. So, and then you plug in with USB-C and recharge it. But that's like versus, I don't know, months or so.
Well, that probably explains why Apple hasn't bothered with it then.
Exactly. And it's a really, like, it's compared to the one that Apple ships, it's a heavy keyboard and it's a little bit taller. So I think that helps a lot with the ergonomics. But I'm still kind of wanting to try out, like an actual, like, weird looking ergonomic keyboard, like one of the split ones, like maybe the, what is it, Microsoft Sculptor or something? I don't know.
Yeah. The Microsoft Sculpt, whatever it's called.
Yeah. Just something that's very different from using a laptop, you know. And I don't have a problem with the mouse and keyboard that Apple shipped with the iMac Pro. But if I'm going to, you know, try something different, then I want it to be way better and not just, you know, better in some ways and worse in others. So I'm having fun with that. More to share on that in the future. Let's also talk about, before we head off, the state of the Apple TV app for Apple TV Plus and where it's been, where it's going. What's new there this week?
Last week, obviously, it launched on Roku. As they announced back in March, they said in March it's coming to, you know, all the four smart TVs and Roku and Amazon Fire TV platform. They didn't actually have release dates for any of these things, but last week we saw Roku drop, and today we saw it launch on the Amazon Fire TV platform, although the device matrix is very complicated. You can read the post, but it's starting on the Fire TV stick and coming to some subset of every other Fire TV. And apparently Fire TV have like actual TVs as well. Like there are Amazon Fire TVs that are TV branded sets with some other person.
Yeah.
So it's coming to some of them as well. It's exactly the same experience you get on the Roku. You know, it's great for if you want to see your purchased iTunes content or you want to watch Apple TV channels. And obviously, Apple's getting all of its ducks in a row ready for the TV Plus launch next Friday. So Amazon Fire TV, it's there.
So this is the Amazon Fire TV Stick 4K and HD models. And these cost, I'm looking at Amazon.
$49 is the 4K one.
Okay, so that's instead of $180. Yeah.
Just a slight difference,
a little bit cheaper,
and a minor difference in the price, and the fact that it's literally a stick that you plug into the back of the thing and not a dedicated box. So, you know, a few advantages.
And the HD version is 40 if you don't have a 4K TV.
Yeah,
man, I mentioned this on the show a while back, but I, you know, if this, you know, when this came as advertised, I wondered if it would be on the stick and not just like the price of your boxes and things like that. But this is the stuff where you have the Alexa voice remote, and that's, I think, more capable than, well, different set of skills than Siri.
What we don't know yet is whether the Apple TV app
integrates,
supports Alexa search. We don't know yet. Yeah.
Okay. But there are things that you can do with these. I guess maybe like volume. Well, man, it really depends, I guess. There's, like you said, the product matrix here is wild. But I think that the Fire TV stuff, Stick stuff, or Fire TV stuff in general, has just better voice control with what you'd like to do with different apps than what Apple offers with Siri.
Yeah, definitely. Because deeper than just Siri is pretty limited.
It's HomeKit, which is cool. But it's
the TV app.
Press the button, and it's the TV. But it's mostly about finding stuff and not doing stuff like changing channels or volume.
Yeah, the Alexa that's on the Fire TV is closer to like an actual Amazon Echo in functionality.
Yeah, I guess my only hesitation is I didn't mention this, but with making permanent HomeKit installations, I've also like ending my experimentation with Echo. You know, I want to be all in on this AirPlay 2 and HomeKit system. And not have a
little bit. Especially with multi-user coming any day now.
I'll tell you what. And so I actually sold a bunch of the Echoes except for my wife's bedside clock. That's hers. I cannot get her to not use it. So even though the HomePod can do alarms, maybe I'll talk her into it. But that's the last thing. And I was even going to keep one Echo Dot in the kitchen for the Echo wall clock, which I think is a very cool product. But in the move, I lost the hour hand on the clock. I don't know where it went. Yeah. So, yeah. All right. And the last thing I want to mention this week before we head off is Jeff Benjamin has published his video review of the Apple Watch Series 5 on youtube.com/95Mac. And also you can find the story on 95Mac.com. But it's a really good look at what the Series 5 does this year. And he has the Space Black Titanium model. He concludes with similar feedback to, you know, what we both had, which was kind of looks like the Space Gray Aluminum for the price, kind of iffy. And he has really good comparisons, and he kind of concludes the same thing, that the natural titanium, you probably get a more different look out of that if you're going for a new material this year. But, you know, he shows Compass, he shows parts of WatchOS 6, he shows how Always On works, and, you know, it includes the acknowledgement that battery life is a trade-off for Always On, but it's one that he makes for how he uses the watch for notifications and as a watch. And with that said, we're on beta 3 now of WatchOS 6.1, and hopefully that's coming in a few weeks, and is the release version of WatchOS 6.1, and everyone gets the benefit of having better Apple Watch battery on the Series 5 or Series 4. Some people had issues there too with WatchOS 6. But I can report now that on most days, I'm getting really good battery life with the Series 5 now, to the point where before I was testing it with the dimness level at the lowest instead of medium or the highest, and noise alerts turned off, just two watch faces and none using location except for the weather complication, really trying to do the simplest things I can. And as it's gotten better with the beta version of WatchOS, I've started doing things like I used to do, like have the brightness turned either to the middle or all the way up so it can max out, have noise alerts on like I had all summer in the beta, and, you know, log longer than 30-minute workouts with it. And I'm now getting really good battery life like you would expect to get. So,
well, that's a relief.
Yeah. Yes, it really, really is.
Apple still won't confirm it officially, but it does seem there is a lot of anecdotal evidence that 6.1 eliminates most of the battery life situation.
Yeah, I put the watch on at 5:30 a.m. this morning, and now it's 4:51 p.m. on Thursday, and I've got 40% battery, and that feels good. You know, so
yeah, that's fine. That'll get you through to the nighttime.
Yeah, and that's after logging a 45-minute bike ride. So it's good stuff. So I will have my review. I'm either gonna try to do it next week or whenever 6.1 comes out, but yeah, we're getting there. And I've also I've got in a few weeks, I've got that big run that I've been, you know, looking forward to, the half marathon at Disney World for the Wine and Dine Festival weekend, and that will be the first of three half marathons this winter that I'll do. And a friend and a guest on the Watch Time podcast that I do, Rahul Mata, who makes the Tempo app for Apple Watch runners with iPhone that use the iPhone for logging their runs. He ran in the Chicago Marathon, so 26.2 miles instead of 13.1, and he used his Series 5, and he published a blog post talking about how the battery life situation was for him, and he wasn't having the fast drainage issue that I had, but even, you know, logging a workout like that without the iPhone, it's really intensive. And so he has like the sort of the mode he put his watch in and the results that he got. And, you know, basically he got through the marathon in respectable time without the watch dying. You know, it was things like using theater mode and turning off Always On and just turning, you know, with theater mode, the screen's actually off too. But that's kind of what you'd expect, you know, based on what they promise, because even with Always On and 18 hours battery, that's with a 1 hour workout, you know, not a, you know, half marathon or not a full marathon. So, so I'm looking forward to having better coverage of the watch in the coming weeks now that the software is, you know, getting ironed out, because I was really excited about the watch, especially from the event, you know, and my actual like usage of it has been a little bit more frustrating, but I think we're actually out of the woods now. So, good things to come there. With that being said, that is the Happy Hour podcast for the week. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Apollo Zach. Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZAMAYA.
And if you have any feedback for the show, you can tweet at us or DM us or email us at happyhour@nf5mac.com. And we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.